God had promised Abraham a son, but his wife Sarah was barren. So Abraham took a second wife at Sarah's suggestion, Hagar, and became the father of Ishmael. Where in the Old Testament, where in Genesis does it say that Abraham did wrong by taking Hagar as a wife? Welcome to Probe. We're continuing our conversations on beginnings and belongings. We're right in the middle of the story of Abraham. My conversation partners are again Paul Dibdall and Larry Baverka from the School of Theology at Walla Walla College, and I want them to face that question. What does Genesis tell us about the rightness or wrongness of Abraham's decision to father a child through Hagar?
So what's wrong with having two wives if the first one doesn't work?
That's the question.
Particularly when the issue is the production of a male heir. That's first and foremost and primary, right?
Okay. So how would you know it was wrong?
You're not really asking about polygamy, are you? Because to me, it's a different issue here. It's not merely an issue about, you know, having multiple wives.
Well,
it has to do with the covenant, the promise.
The Levirate law was what we would call serial polygamy, isn't it? Where if the first husband is not able to produce a male heir and he dies, then the brother must, if he is unmarried and does not have sons, must mm-hmm. produce a male heir mm-hmm. with that.
Of course, that's multiple on the male side, not multiple on the female side.
Oh, she's only the wife of one husband?
Well, there are several males involved in the story, whereas here you're talking about several females involved.
Oh, that's different if it's males or females.
We wouldn't allow either one today, would we? And if not, why not?
Well, we have our form of it. That's why I'm using the word serial polygamy.
Serial polygamy.
Yeah.
Okay. But if this were on TV, our listeners would be able to see the twinkle in your eye, Larry.
Oh.
Oh, yes. Now, I'm dealing seriously. Let me tell you why. I had a class several years ago that was supposed to be for religion majors, serious Bible students, but who didn't have biblical languages. And I discovered to my... It was very troubling to me to discover that at least six of those students out of a class of 13, it was a small class, didn't really know enough about their Bibles to deal with the stuff that we were supposed to be dealing with in the class. So I changed the course requirements and said, I want you to read 8 hours, beginning with the story of Abram, Genesis 12, 8 hours. Well, I had one young woman who came from a somewhat troubled background, but it was an Adventist Christian home that she'd grown up, more or less. She spent the full 8 hours reading just from Genesis 12 to 25, which wasn't my intention. No, I wanted her to make some really good progress, but she spent a lot of time just giving a detailed summary, but she gave me almost no reaction. So I pressed her orally and asked her, well, what did you think when you read that stuff? And finally she opened up. She says, I was sitting on the edge of my seat. I'd always been taught that it was wrong to take a second wife. And I was waiting all the way through for God to tell Abram it was wrong to take the second wife, and he never did. That's the way she put it. In other words, the moral judgments on something that we would consider to be wrong simply weren't there in the Genesis narrative. Now, I would point out that the disastrous results of this are clear enough, but there's no overt moralizing, shame on you, Abraham. It's simply implied in the narrative.
And that's true, isn't it? Not just with Abraham taking a second wife, but with most of what happens in the Old Testament, it seems to me like it tells the story. You see the results of decisions, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of that kind of moralizing, you know, end of the children's story, now boys and girls, the moral of the story is you should do this or you should do that. I don't think we find much of that.
Mm-mm.
in Genesis, at least. It's just laid out there for us with all kinds of implications.
And that's especially true in Genesis, and we'll look at these in the next few weeks, where you see the stories of Isaac and Jacob and the multiple wives there. It's just amazing how Scripture crafts that in such a way that when you get through, you kind of take your breath.
But isn't that the sign of a good story?
Sure.
And telling the story well, and that is, you bring then to the story your own moral judgments. You see the obvious, which then draws from you a conclusion, or there is a call for you to somehow live or do differently and learn from what you see here.
But what we have done is then to make clear-cut moral standards, this is not to be done. We would not encourage any of our children or any of our siblings to experiment the way Abraham did. And it becomes a moral code with much narrower parameters. See?
Well, I mean, how much of this, though, is in some way culturally defined? I mean, Abraham lived in a culture among people where this was not an aberration, per se. For us to do this, we would be in trouble with the laws of the land, not just a moral challenge or difficulty.
But my point, Larry, would be that God is reaching Abraham at a point where probably the male ego had led to certain deviations from right principles. Sure, it's culturally conditioned. But I would want to argue as a Christian that it is a much superior way of living to have one man, one wife, and not to approach these issues in the way that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob necessarily did. In other words, I'd say, sure, culture plays a key role, but I'm not going to use that simply as a justification.
Well, this is another example, then, of the Joshua 24 text,
where absolutely
the knowledge of how things began, what God's idea was, had somehow been lost along the way.
And what you find then is a story of God nudging us through this story to see with greater clarity, no, what Abraham did, what Jacob did, that's not something that I would recommend. And the community then makes it much more explicit to our children, that's not an option we want you to clear.
And I think the point of the story is not, I shouldn't say the point, but a more major point of the story beyond even, you know, only have one wife. I think a greater issue here is Abram and Sarah's impatience with the promise and their decision to take matters into their own hands, so to speak, and sort of help God along. And I think that's, you know, for me, the temptation to take a Hagar, so to speak, is not a huge issue for me personally. But every day, I think we face the
it would
temptation
be for your wife, though.
I'm just going to keep going and finish. the greater temptation is to take matters into my own hands and try to solve problems in my own way rather than allowing God to work out His way and with His timing.
Now, let's take another story, which is here, the conversations over Sodom. That one, again, is a story that I remember being astonished when I actually heard it. I'd read it many times without hearing it. But God says, I've heard rumors about Sodom and Gomorrah. This is in Genesis 18. Pretty bad. I need to share this with Abraham because he's a man of some worth. And then you get into this amazing conversation. Abraham says, in effect, you're going to do what? You're the God of all the earth. You ought to know better than that. I mean, this outright challenge, you cannot destroy the wicked and the innocent together. And then would you spare it for 50? This conversation goes all the way down to 10. I would be interested in how the two of you react to this kind of overt confrontation of the human to the divine. In my early years, I would have felt very uncomfortable about confronting God in this way. I remember the stories of the two she-bears who were a little bit impolite. Well, I wasn't going to make that mistake again.
Well, this certainly is an indication of the kind of relationship and friendship that that Abraham had with God. It does harken back in some ways to the Adam story, where Adam and God walk and talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's an idyllic kind of picture, at least in that sense, where mm-hmm. where this conversation can take place. And I mean, we're not talking about equals here, but somehow Abraham sees himself as someone who can meet God on his own ground
mm-hmm.
and reason with him and appeal to his goodness.
And that's why some scholars would say the roots of secularization are very much in the Old Testament, because that way of confronting the divine is basically what one could call a secular approach. You don't respect the divine because it's divine, you shut up. No, you confront the divine. And of course, I think that kind of interactive relationship between the human and the divine is important in terms of the great cosmic conflict. So it shaped very much Christian theology, at least one side of Christian theology, and you find it here in Genesis 18.
And elsewhere in the Old Testament as well, that where people talk back to God, why are you doing this? Why don't you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Jacob wrestles with God. I won't let go until there's this dynamic which we mm-hmm. see throughout the Old Testament.
Now, I don't know how your own personalities relate to this. I was liberated in almost an ecstatic sense when I discovered that it was all right to raise those kinds of questions to God. I distinctly remember when we were in Europe once, there was an earthquake, and a little church in the Italian Alps collapsed, killing 100 worshipers. You know, the anger there, and my freedom to be able to say, God, what's going on here? Now, half of the Psalms or those kinds of psalms. But it seems to me that in many believing circles, that becomes very difficult. We just kind of, we accept whatever happens. Now, at the end of the day, I want to. But our freedom to be able to confront God with the evils of this world, I think, are an important part mm-hmm. of the life which we live here.
Mm-hmm. And I think God is, secure enough or big enough to handle people who ask questions with emotion, even. I don't think God is threatened by that. I think he even welcomes that.
I wonder to what extent this story illustrates a kind of integrity that is growing with Abraham. I mean, he's duplicitous as the story starts, but now he is a man who really levels now with God.
And I think that's terribly important as we go on. Now, next week, we'll finish up the story of Abraham, and we get the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, or at least very near. So we'll pick up these pieces again, and Paul and Larry will be on board as we discuss these things. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.